Well, to kind of start out with, I'd love to know, I know you and Jillian both have connections to you know, people in the military, but I'm curious, when you guys decided to do a project, did you always have the idea of it being looking at the different wars? I mean, it's one of the fascinating things about Surviving Home is you guys are dealing with, you know, World War II, you're dealing with Vietnam, you're also dealing with the you know, the more modern ones, the Persian and Iraq wars. I mean, this is so vast in its choice in that level. Was that always in the running of what you guys wanted to do?
It was not always. No, that was part of our pre-production discovery that we thought that might be something that hasn't necessarily been done before and something that might be really an interesting lens through which to look at veteran stories. I mean, I have been fascinated with the story of my own grandfather who was killed in World War II when my dad was like an eight-month-old baby. So I think that did factor into it. My grandfather, Mark Bingaman, was killed on the USS Franklin aircraft carrier. And since my dad was so young, of course, he never knew him, and he grew up with the father who my grandmother remarried. So he ended up having that man's last name. So I just found it fascinating that, you know, this guy, my real paternal grandfather, served his country. He served in the 30s, and then he re-enlisted when Pearl Harbor happened. Very similarly to how one of the veterans in our film, Bobby Henlein, already served in Desert Storm, came back without any physical injuries, and then re-enlisted after 9/11 when there was an attack on our own soil. It was interesting to see that parallel between my own grandfather in World War II and Bobby. But in any case, I just found it fascinating that, you know, I'm this guy's grandson. I don't even have his last name, and I can't even find anybody who knows him, all because of his sacrifice that came from serving our country. But that was a little circuitous, but essentially, you know, Jillian and I are both editors for our professions, and so, you know, we're storytellers for a living. But when we decided that we wanted to actually make our own film, we kind of thought that, I guess it was about 5 years into the current ongoing war in Iraq, and we just thought that seeing so many stories, so many Dateline pieces where our veterans were coming back with traumatic brain injuries, post-traumatic stress, and we, you know, didn't necessarily know any veterans, and it seemed that veterans were isolated. So that was kind of the initial incident, was just looking at that landscape, and then from there we kind of brainstormed that a transgenerational way of telling veteran stories would probably be new and highly informative to really to veterans and civilians as audience members. I'll stop talking now.
I've got to ask then, because it is fascinating to see the different types of personalities that come from the different types of war. But I'm curious, how did you guys decide on these specific people after kind of realizing that you wanted to do something so broad? Because, I mean, it is bold what you guys have done. And I'm curious, what was the order of the actual veterans coming into y'all's film?
Well, we thought it would make sense to start with the oldest veterans first. So we went and found, we were very interested in the Nisei story, which is the first generation Japanese American veterans who served in World War II, the 442nd and the 100th. Jillian's dad is Japanese American and he served in Korea. But we found that that particular story was extremely specific and couldn't really be folded into the film that we were making So we do intend to perhaps use a lot of that footage to make another film or a short. But in any case, we started with those World War II veterans. One of them is in the film, in some of the topical sections where you hear various other veterans' voices who aren't the main veterans who we follow. Norman is in the film. But it really, when you commit to making a documentary and commit to taking however long it takes, it really just kind of, the subjects avail themselves to you almost more than you actively finding them. Bobby Henlein, we heard about because Jillian went to college with a woman named Sarah, who is the sister of Bobby's physical therapist. Bobby is the severely burned Iraq War veteran. So we were able to get his direct email just through a conversation that Jillian was having with her friend Sarah, and that was how we got to actually visit Bobby in San Antonio, and then meet with him as you saw on many, many occasions after that. Claude Anshin Thomas, the Zen Buddhist monk and Vietnam veteran, that one we actually did, so I'll actually walk back what I said. That one we actually did actively find and pursue based on an article in the LA Times that Jillian saw about a veteran who was a Buddhist monk that facilitated veterans retreats utilizing mindfulness and meditation as a way of dealing with or trying to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder, or as I learned, he prefers to call it post-traumatic stress, so I call it that as well, because it's not a disorder, it's a natural consequence of the experiences that your brain isn't really prepared to take on. But that one we were able to, he's a Buddhist monk, and he is just available to anyone, and his email is available. So when he received our first email and understood the type of story we were trying to tell, he was just interested, and that was one of the other early people that we met with and followed for a very long time. I went to his Zen center in Florida, and that was the first time that I myself ever attempted or did any sitting meditation, which is the first thing that we did together. And there are too many details to go into, but suffice it to say that meeting him would transformed my life. I would say making this film in general transformed our lives. Much we expected it to, really, but it did so much more than we could have ever expected. So really, get the mix of how we encountered people. Tracy Cooper Harris, she and her wife took on the federal government to affect change that is going to make things much better for veterans coming home now forever. I won't say exactly what the nature of that case was, because people can see that when they go see the film. But Trey, we found because one of the veterans that we met at the veterans retreat that was facilitated by Buddhist monk Claude Anshin Thomas was friends with her because they had classes together at Pasadena City College. So we were able to get her email from this guy that we met, Cameron, and she was also very interested. Everyone found it compelling that it was going to be multiple generations. So we did get the sense that we were onto something with that.
You know, I was fascinated at, I mean, obviously the personalities of each person really becomes the movies, and I think it's you've got such amazing people in their will to do something after war, but I found myself laughing and even being moved in ways I didn't expect while watching this movie. I think Bobby in particular has a very strong personality that allows for comfort, even though he's probably been through one of the more horrific tales. And as you said, something where he survived a war and then went back to a different war, and that's when he suffered his you know, the things he's been through. I'm curious, once you'd met these wonderful people, did you expect to have levity in it? I don't find that Surviving Home is necessarily like a sad documentary at all, or tough to watch even. It's uplifting in so many levels. Did you always notice that, or was that kind of a surprise to you guys while filming it as well and getting to meet these people?
It doesn't. I get where you're coming from. It doesn't and didn't surprise us per se, because I think it just comes from having dealt with a lot of different types of material as an editor and a storyteller. Like I said, I have seen that enduring extremely challenging and emotional circumstances does tend to bring out unexpected ways of dealing with it that do involve humor a lot. So I wasn't surprised by it, but I'm glad that you're bringing it up, because I do think that actually that is one of the things that people should know, and is one of the even Claude Anshin Thomas, who is a mindful Buddhist monk, is also a very, very funny individual himself. And yeah, so it didn't surprise us, but I think that it is a way of kind of taking something and you know, it's still something very challenging, but you can turn it in a way where it's both challenging and you're looking at it like, huh, I can get through this, and I can see something other than pain in it. Obviously, Bobby would be the primary example of that. I think that the first, most people I do believe know that he's a stand-up, that he started trying to do stand-up comedy. So I don't think I'm spoiling anything for anyone, but I do think that the first joke that he has at LOL Comedy Club in San Antonio is utterly hilarious, and I won't say what it is, but it's still resonates today because of the subject matter of what he's talking about. This isn't very interesting because I'm being too general, so I'll finish with that.
Well, I love it. I definitely hope people, when they see it, will fully gather what you're getting at. And I kind of want to touch upon the other thing that you can't talk too much about, because it's a part of the film, and now it's a part of history, luckily. The Cooper Harris story is a trauma that I don't think people think of directly when they think of war and veterans. It's a subject matter that is so, it's so much more in depth. How did you guys get her and her wife to be so open? And also, I think that's a story that so many people just have no idea is as sadly maybe as rampant as it could be. And how pivotal their story is to hopefully the change of the way the military is run and handled. Can you talk about just that impact? This seems very momentable to see what we're seeing when we see her story, because it is something that trauma-wise I don't think comes to mind, is, you know, trauma through your brothers, basically, in arms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. As she says, you know, she didn't think she would have to be watching her back for the people who are supposed to be watching her back. You know, and there have been full documentaries just on that subject, but nonetheless, yeah, I still think that in the general consciousness, people don't really think of that as one of the traumas that somebody can bring home with them. In as regards, you know, speaking with Trey about that. We didn't force that issue, and you know, it's really just about being a really good listener and letting people tell you what they want to tell you. Obviously, I think making a documentary, if you don't have the trust of your subjects, then you won't get something you won't get an impactful film. But yeah, I think it was just a matter of letting her tell us when she wanted to tell us. And if I might just deviate from your specific question for a second, it just reminded me of something that has been a little bit of a revelation from making this film. There seems to be a sense that, you know, civilians might feel, this is just in general, the relationship between civilians and veterans and what civilians can do to be supportive. I think that veterans have had, many, many different veterans expressed that, you know, they don't feel comfortable speaking with civilians about some of the things that are more challenging, some of the memories that they had that are more challenging, and that's completely understandable. But our film is about connection and what can grow from that. And I think what we learned is that, well, one, we learned that, you know, much less even than 1% of our country is currently serving in the military. So there's an inherent divide in this particular day and age between civilians and veterans. In World War II, you know, a lot more people were involved in the war effort. First of all, just a lot more people, there was a draft, so a lot more people were actually serving, but people were also participating in and supporting the war effort at home. In any case, what I was driving at is that even though civilians might not, you know, understand some of the things that only other veterans would understand, what we learned is that there's still a huge potential for coming together, and it doesn't have to be talking about those things. It doesn't have to be anything that a veteran wouldn't want to talk about, but it's as though people are treating, may have the idea that they should not even ask a veteran any question or say, hey, are you a veteran? And what we learned is that, you know, if you see that somebody has a tattoo or they're wearing something, it's perfectly appropriate, and I think should be encouraged, to just have simple human interaction and say, hey, it looks like, did you serve in the military? And even that small act, I think, does something to bridge the inherent divide that I was referring to earlier. Just numerically, there's just a huge divide. But just the act of listening and expressing interest, even just on a basic level, I think goes an extremely long way. And just being a good listener and letting somebody feel, you know, that someone is interested in them is valuable. And if someone doesn't want to talk, then they certainly won't. But I feel like maybe people go too far in, you know, steering clear of even asking somebody if they serve in the military, as far as civilians go. Okay, so that was a big detour from what you were actually asking me about. What was I supposed to be talking about there?
No, I think Tracy, you answered it both sides perfectly, and yeah. I appreciate what you gave us info about, because that kind of bleeds into my next question, which I love the fact in the film that we get to see veterans in different places. Normally, I think when we think of a film, we're stuck in one area of the country, but how much travel did you and Jillian have to go through to make this film?
Quite a bit. You know, it was fortunate that we live in the Los Angeles area, and Tracy and Maggie live in Pasadena, so that is not particularly far. But yeah, there was a good amount of traveling. I don't know what else to say about that, but yeah, the longest single trip, and probably the reason that my life was somewhat radically transformed by Claude Anshin Thomas, the Buddhist monk, Vietnam veteran. The longest continuous trip, we spent my childhood best friend, Tim Shriver, agreed to help me. We spent, I think, a good 2.5 weeks traveling through Western Pennsylvania with Claude Anshin Thomas and Wiebke Kenshin Anderson, who is his assistant, who's now actually a fully ordained Buddhist monk herself. At that time, she was his assistant, she was his student. But that was a very long trip, and there's plenty of material that ultimately is not in the final cut. But yeah, there was a lot of travel.
Another element of the film that moved me, that it's not as apparent, but I do want to ask you about it. The music that you utilize and working with James on the score, I was surprised at times and moved at times by y'all's choices and James's choices in this. Can you tell me a bit about adding that element to the film? Because I do think it's something that many other filmmakers maybe don't put as much effort. I think that you guys do. I think it's very touching the way you guys choose the music in this film.
Well, you're just giving me goosebumps now for asking that question. James did such an amazing job. James T. Sale, our composer, we interviewed a couple, I think three different people, and his ability to identify personally with Claude Anshin Thomas's story and with the need for a film like this to exist, and that he wants to show it to his children post haste. Those were things that made us definitely feel that we should choose him. Also, the music that some of the other things that he had composed that he let us listen to felt like tonally and emotionally he had what we wanted. But you know, when you're working on something like this, you just make a temp score out of all the best composers in the world. You just take music from everywhere and you sculpt the emotion of all the scenes. But there's a limit to what you can do, because a real composer can actually, you know, come up with motifs and instrument choices that track across the arc of each character, or across the emotional arc of the film, or both. And that's what James did an absolutely amazing job with. And just, you know, it's a very abstract thing to be able to increase the emotion that the viewer feels, and music can, you know, exponentially increase how emotional you feel about information or a scene that you're receiving. And yeah, we're, if you can't tell, ecstatic with James and his score. So yeah, we were very lucky that we picked the right person, because we could have very easily, you know, I'm sure if you got a composer that you couldn't communicate well with, you know, you would have a lot harder time, and you wouldn't have the emotion. It really comes back to the emotion that it brings.
I'd love to ask, when you guys decide to, you have the finished product, you've got the film, you decide to release it to the world, tell me a bit about the choices you guys have made on the journey so far. I know you guys ended up in Bentonville, which I think is a kind of a fascinating film festival to be at. And also, you know, being able to bring it here to Dallas, we're very excited. Even though it's not in a festival circumstance, it's a much more intimate veteran festival for us that's very specific to just a few amount of films. Can you tell me a bit about the journey you guys have wanted to take Surviving Home on, and what made you decide to go the way you have?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, before I forget, I just want to say that regarding this North Texas Vet Fest coming up this weekend, I think that the idea of this Veterans Institute for Film and Media, which is essentially what we are all raising money for in participating in this, I think it is kind of a festival to some degree. It's just the first year of it. You know, this Veterans Institute for Film and Media is a fantastic idea, and I think that it can be incredibly therapeutic and can really help both veterans to process their own stories in the process of making, you know, a short film or whatever medium they choose to use to express themselves. So I think the idea of starting something like that for veterans' stories, you know, it's a double benefit in terms of, as I just said, for them to be able to process and get their own stories out, veterans, but also for more veteran stories and more the veteran narrative to be taken in by our civilian population and out into the consciousness. So I think we're super happy to be participating in that. As far as the film's journey, yeah, the Bentonville Film Festival, the festival that was founded by Gina Davis and this other fellow, his name is Trevor Drinkwater, I believe, maybe only about 4 years ago. That was a very interesting festival. That was an interesting festival because my parents, to get out of the northern Iowa winters about 5 years ago, retired to that exact area. So that was funny. So they were down there for that festival. But yeah, we premiered at the St. Louis International Film Festival, and we went to Sedona International Film Festival, then Julian Dubuque International Film Festival in Dubuque, Iowa, another actually maybe lesser known but really well-respected festival. Vail Film Festival was amazing because we won the audience award there for being the best overall film at that festival. And on the horizon, actually, we have a bunch of other festivals this fall. One we were incredibly excited about, which we just heard about this week, it is the Chicago International Social Change Film Festival. And I just like how those words all sound together. They sound really good. Also, we have the Kansas International Film Festival. The first one after Dallas this weekend is the GI Film Festival. That's in San Diego this year, and we did just receive word that we are not just going to the festival, but we are nominated for their national award for best feature documentary. So that's exciting. So I think that we'll just kind of continue the festival circuit, you know, for not that many more months, maybe another 3 or 4 months. And then I think the hope, you know, the spectrum of hope would be from Netflix, HBO, Showtime, or, you know, possibly Amazon. I'm not really sure. I'm not sure exactly. It's funny because we're in this industry, but the distribution thing is still new to us. So we're just kind of zenning that process out as we go, and also encountering a lot of people at each one of these festivals that might actually have an impact on that. I think there are a couple other festivals that I can't announce yet as well that I think we're also going to be getting into and should have a good representation of distributors there and stuff. But basically, I think that we just want to maximize people's access to these amazing stories that our veterans were so, you know, brave to actually share with us and let us in for. So really, whatever that means. It's funny when we do a You know, you can do a boosted Facebook post. You can spend some money on your credit card, and you can target a certain area. So I do that when we have festivals to get audience there. But the amount of messages that we get requesting that we bring the film to different organizations is pretty, it's pretty stunning. Actually, if you want to hear one,
definitely
rewarding anecdote, I'll tell you that when we screened at the Julian Dubuque International Film Festival up in Iowa, there was a fellow who I met there. His name is Shane. He saw Surviving Home there in Dubuque, and then he saw it because of one of my boosted posts, which was awesome, with my Facebook posts. He drove up there from the Quad Cities, which is not close, but not far, really. He saw the film, and he actually works at the Vet Center. The Vet Center is part of the VA. It's a part of the VA that I think was started by Vietnam veterans at some point. But anyway, he works at the Vet Center, and he really wanted us to bring the film to the Quad Cities so that some of his clients could see it, and also because there's a giant arsenal there, the Rock Island Arsenal. It's a pretty substantial military population there. So even though we were still on the festival circuit, we weren't necessarily thinking we were going to be doing outreach screenings quite yet. Shane really thought that should happen, and I was like, well, then it should happen, because if people want to see these stories and he thinks that they would benefit from it, then there's no reason we shouldn't do it. So we did that about a month ago or so, and I went out there for that. We had a really, really great turnout, and it was reported to me I think the day after that there were a couple, maybe I think it was three or two already, just the day after, there were a couple veterans who called up and made appointments to start talking about some of the things that they had never talked about before. So for that to happen, that's really humbling, and it's also just the dream. That's exactly, you know, one of the effects that we want to have, other than bridging the gap, would just be for to have veterans who are, you know, maybe not quite ready to talk with somebody, feel like maybe because of some of the other stories that they heard in our film and seeing these men and women open up, maybe they start the conversation with somebody. It could even just be starting the conversation with their own spouse, which we've heard as well. We got some feedback that, you know, someone's husband for the first time started talking about things with his wife, and she was really kind of blown away that was happening after so many years. So
I've got to ask then, since you teased it at the very beginning, you guys obviously have a lot of footage that didn't make it into this film, and with the possibilities of where you can take this film, I know the business side of it obviously is going to be down the line, but as far as footage wise, is there hopes to continue this journey for you guys even further into, you know, Norman's story or different stories? Are you guys filming right now? I mean, what you guys are doing, I think, is very special, and I'd love to know, you know, is there ideas of making this into something even bigger than just one-off film, or maybe even a series, or just a way of, you know, doing different films in the future?
Yes. Jillian, one of the producers that we brought onto the film is a fellow by the name of Frederick Marks. He was one of the producers of a very, very successful documentary called Hoop Dreams, which came out, I think, in the mid-90s. He is making a veterans film currently, and one of his associates, I think, has a finished film. So we are starting a consortium where we'll be also setting up screenings across the country with those other films. That's not really what you were asking, but we are doing that going forward. Our footage, interestingly, as I was telling you at the beginning, how my grandfather Mark Bingaman was almost as though he was erased from ever existing, as far as me being his grandson, or even my father not even knowing what he was like or never having a chance to meet him, growing up with a completely different last name. One of the things that didn't fit in this film, but I did as a result of making this film, was I went to the USS Franklin. It's an aircraft carrier. It's an Essex-class aircraft carrier that was bombed on March 19th, 1945, the day that my grandfather was killed, along with 800 other sailors. I went to a reunion for the USS Franklin up in Minneapolis a few years ago, right during the middle of making this film, because I thought, well, maybe I can find somebody who could at least tell me what type of guy he was, or just anything about him. I had a lot of really cool pictures, actually, that we got, that my grandmother gave to my dad. So I knew that he lived in Arlington, and he had a really, seemed like he was doing really well. They had a really neat life. I actually went to his house that was in Arlington when we were doing another shoot. It looked exactly the same, brick Cape Cod. Anyway, so I went to this reunion, and there was a river cruise down the Mississippi. So I took some different pictures that I printed out of Mark Bingaman, my grandfather, posted them up on the walls during this cruise, and made an announcement, hey, if any of you guys know my grandfather, Mark Bingaman, this is him, you know, I'd love to talk to you. And eventually, one guy came up to me, and he was like, I don't know him, but there's this guy, Howard, he wasn't feeling well today, but he was also a yeoman. My grandfather was, his rank was yeoman first class. He was like, you should talk to him, he's back at the hotel. So when I went back to the hotel, I called up to the guy's room. He didn't answer, but I went up there. I knocked on his door. I filmed myself doing this, like, selfie style. And he answered the door, and I showed him the picture, and I was like, hey, I'm here with the reunion. Sorry to bother you, but I was just wondering if you might know my grandfather, Mark Bingaman. This is him. And the guy said, I know him well. And I was like, what? So I was like, oh my God. And I went in there and I sat down and interviewed him for a while. And since you've seen the film, it seems, I can tell you that, well, first of all, the first frames of the film are from March 19th, 1945, on the USS Franklin. There's a big wall of smoke. You see a man running out of there. That's the first frames of the film. So that's right during the moment that my grandfather was killed. But also during one of the sections where you hear from some of the other veterans who we met but whom we didn't follow extensively, that man Howard, who knew my grandfather, is part of one of those. He's the guy who says that the flashbacks are what really bother him, especially around March 19th, so there's some more footage of that moment. So that was crazy. And of course, you probably are interested to know whether he could tell me anything about my grandfather's personality, because that was my quest. And when I asked him about my grandfather's personality, he said, oh, he was very gallant. He was the kind of guy who, if you asked him a stupid question, he wouldn't say, oh, you're a dumbass. He was very nice. I was like, oh, awesome. That's really good. That matches his pictures. So that was pretty cool. So I, you know, now that I've given up the entire plot, my chances of making but I might make a short film out of that for those people who don't listen to your broadcast of this interview.
Well, Matt, I really appreciate the time. I was blown away by the movie. We help with festivals, so it's kind of funny how we finagle our way into seeing things. We work on the DCPs and the projection side of things. So lastly, I would just love to know, you've mentioned throughout this interview that you've been changed by meeting these people. How cathartic is this experience been, and is this something that you and Jillian are your lives completely on a different trajectory because of this project?
I can only, I should only speak for myself, but yes, my life is on a completely different trajectory because of this project. It really is. I was on a good trajectory before I started this film, and I don't want to make it seem as though it wasn't all of the veterans who affected me, because it all came together to affect this change. But mainly, as I mentioned, it was Claude Anshin Thomas who did have a profound impact on me, because he, through figuring out how to find peace for himself within his unpeacefulness, and dealing with finding a new way, a new relationship with his memories and his experiences, he ended up becoming a Buddhist monk, and that means that he practices mindfulness, he practices mindful speech, he looks at every instant, every moment, and realizes that he has the potential to either contribute to violence, whatever that could mean, even in the smallest way, saying, being short with somebody, you know, the choices that you make, whether you contribute to, you know, something like a tremendous amount of suffering that takes place at a factory farm because you purchase certain things and you eat those things. All of those things made me just realize, and just he made me aware of the fact that, you know, what, I was like 38 or 39 years old when I met him. And it just made me aware that I had a lot of conditioning. There's a lot of things that I was doing just because that was my conditioning. I used to drink a lot of beer. I used to, you know, I wasn't like out of control, but because of him, I don't drink at all. I don't eat the animals or the dairy products. I don't swear, which I used to do all the time. I just basically really embraced this idea that, and this isn't a quote from him, I think this might be a quote from maybe Thich Nhat Hanh even or something, but if you want the world to be different, then you as an, if I want the world to be different, then I individually have to live differently. And so I just started trying to really take inventory of my every little behavior, and whether that was something that I agreed with or just something that I did because that was just how my life was. It was my conditioning. That's what we do as Americans. That's what we do as Iowans. I grew up in Iowa. That's what we do. People who, you know, you have a lot of conditioning, and you may not be behaving in a way that's actually congruent with, you know, what you really believe in, which maybe could really just be boiled down to the golden rule to some degree. So yeah, that's my deal was I just flipped and just stopped doing all the stuff that actually I didn't agree with, and I can credit Claude Anshin Thomas for that. So it was pretty significant.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for the time. Thank you for making this film and allowing us to hopefully go on our own journeys by seeing this. And I'm really excited to see what happens next week when the festival is here.
Me too. Sorry I'm so verbose.